This is day one of this December 2018 session. I'm going to be reading from the Thai master Ajahn Chah. I have a book here. It's entitled Being Dharma, The Essence of the Buddha's Teaching. I've read from him a number of years back. I think Amala Sensei has read from him some as well. Pretty remarkable guy. And he died, I guess, in 1992, I think, and was born in 1919. So pretty contemporary. And I'll read a little bit here from the foreword, just to get to know him a little bit before we read directly from his words. This book was translated by one of his disciples, one of the Westerners who came to Thailand and studied with him. He would give talks just about every night, long rambling talks. I think they went along from maybe an hour to sometimes 5 hours. At which point they became something of an endurance test for the monks there. So let me just read from the foreword. This is written by Jack Kornfield. Many people know of him. He says, when the first Western disciples, he was, by the way, one of Ajahn Chah's Western disciples. When the first Western disciples arrived at Wat Pa Pong in the 1960s, Ajahn Chah did not give them the special admiration and treatment that Western monks often received in Thailand. He did not excuse them from any of the demanding challenges and strict training of the monastery. Seated on a wooden bench at the foot of his cottage in the center of a huge forest, he peered at them like a watchmaker taking off the cover of an intriguing new piece, and demanded to know whether they understood suffering or how to find peace in this world. Then he would laugh in welcome and bid them to listen, and if they dared, to join him in practice for a while. In those years, the monastic community was relatively small, and Ajahn Chah was still unknown as a teacher. 25 years later, he had become one of the most honored and revered forest masters of the century, and in 1993, nearly a million people joined the king and queen of Thailand at his funeral in order to pay their last respects at his temple. By then, his influence had spread worldwide, with 100 branch monasteries and respected disciples teaching internationally. So one of the lights of the 20th century, we could safely say. And then I'm going to read a little bit from the translator's preface. This is somebody named Paul Breiter, studied with Ajahn Chah. There's a picture of him sweeping in Thailand in 1974. He says, Ajahn Chah constantly pushed people past what they were likely to consider their limits. The practice in his monasteries did not always follow what might seem to be reasonable, and the routine was always changing. He sometimes recounted his own difficulties in practice and the resolve with which he faced them and spurred himself on. And this is his words. Before I started to practice, I thought to myself, the Buddhist religion is here, available for all, yet why do only some people practice it while others don't? Or if they do practice, they only do so for a short while and then give up. And those who don't give up still don't knuckle down and do the practice. Why is this? So I resolved to myself, okay, I'll give up body and mind for this lifetime and try to follow the teaching of the Buddha down to the last detail. I'll reach understanding in this lifetime, because if I don't, I'll still be sunk in suffering. I'll let go of everything else and make a determined effort. No matter how much difficulty or suffering I have to endure, I'll persevere. If I don't do it, I'll just keep on doubting. Thinking like this, I got down to practice. No matter how much difficulty I had to endure, I did it. I looked on my whole life as if it were only one day and a night. I gave it up. I'll follow the teaching of the Buddha. I'll follow the Dharma to understand why this world is so wretched. I wanted to know. I wanted to see the truth, so I turned to the practice of Dharma. Well, this is rare. This is a rare level of determination. One can't help feeling humbled when you see somebody who's so thoroughly committed. And you understand how important that commitment is to going all the way. Not satisfied with an experience or a little bit of peace, really wanting to know right to the bottom. It says, while he was tolerant of most people's shortcomings and limitations, and that's a really good point. It's always something wrong with our practice when we're comparing ourselves to others and we're critical of the effort that they're making. Everybody is doing what they need to do at this point. It's true, if people tend to fall back, it's going to limit what they can do, but it's so revealing about our own lack of faith when we're continually looking at other people and measuring how they come up short, or measuring how they're better than us, either way. While he was most tolerant of people's shortcomings and limitations, he always wanted his disciples to make as much effort as they possibly could, simply for the goal of escaping from the clutches of Mara, the evil one, who holds us prisoner in this realm of suffering. Mara is sort of the Buddhist version of Satan, the tempter. He did not see this as something easily accomplished. If practicing Dharma were easy, everyone would be doing it, he often said, but is really the only thing worth doing with a human life. This is a big step in our practice when we understand how worthwhile practice is, to practice the Dharma. The worldly way of living generally involves filling life with busyness, distractions, and amusements in an endless pursuit of happiness in an effort to avoid boredom. This was written in the year 2000, and we've stepped it up a notch since then, I think. But a constantly distracted and excited mind is a tired and worried mind. When a person makes a commitment to undergo Buddhist training, he or she is setting out to free the mind from all such dependence. It can be an extremely painful and frustrating process as accumulated habits, hopes, and fears start to surface in the new open space of non-distraction. This is tell people when they're first starting with Zazen, when they're first trying to quiet the mind, the first lesson we get is just how distracted our minds are, how full of thoughts about the self, hopes and fears and anxiety, greed, anger, and ignorance. Ajahn Chah pointed out that there are people who think monastic life is some kind of escape, but when it is actually undertaken, facing oneself for the first time with nowhere to hide can be like walking into a raging storm. And of course, what we're doing here in Sesshin, Roshi is often says, this is like being monks or nuns for this short period of time. Going into Sesshin can be like walking into a raging storm. Ajahn Chah often speaks about heedlessness. By that term, he means a careless, unaware approach to living, and he notes that it is often compounded by comforts. But until one starts to do without such things, these links remain hidden. Soft living tends to make the mind soft. He spoke about the simple way of life in the not-too-distant past in Thailand. Before, when the country was not developed, everyone built their toilet some distance from the house, often out in the forest. You had to walk out there to use it. But now the toilet has to be in the house. The city people even have to have it right there where they sleep. Such a concept struck him as funny. Laughing, he said, "People think that will make them more comfortable and happy to have a toilet in their bedroom. But it doesn't really bring happiness, and it increases the habit of laziness." So easy to get caught up into finding things that are more convenient, using our cleverness to organize our lives in a way that we think will be more pleasant. And yet, people are not happier. And we find that ourselves. It doesn't bring happiness. The Dalai Lama said, "The West has perfected samsara." So much depression, so much anxiety, so much comfort. His way of training was not meant to be an endurance test, however. When he saw disciples making great efforts in a mindless, mechanical way, he would correct them. And he was never ambiguous about where the emphasis should lie. After the Buddha's years of fruitless asceticism, he came to realize the way to liberation lay in the mind. The body itself was just a material object incapable of enlightenment. It was also not something evil that hindered spiritual development and needed to be tortured or weakened. This is as much a deviation as trying to beautify the body and seeking happiness through sensual pleasure, sensual pleasure and social approval. So the role of asceticism is in creating simplicity and non-involvement in confusion, not deprivation for its own sake. And statements such as "destroy your body" or "destroy the world" do not literally refer to suicide or nuclear weapons, but in the context of meditation and Ajahn Chah's lively way of teaching, to destroying attachment to these things. So this is really part of the art of practice, is finding the balance between effort and relaxation. Learning to work with the mind and not with the body. It's so easy for tension to accumulate in the body when we're trying to focus the mind, but it's counterproductive. Really like the emphasis that the Chinese Chan masters, thinking specifically of Sheng Yan, put on relaxation. Body needs to be relaxed and comfortable. The recommendation is to let yourself relax into your cushion. That is to realize that your body is supported. We don't have to hold the body up. There's a cushion underneath us. The body's centered on the cushion, shoulders relaxed, the chest is open. The effort comes with the mind. Breathing well regulated. Maybe pulling the chin in a little bit, stretching the back of the neck. But when we start to feel tension in the chest, then we know that we're working with the body and not with the mind. Working with the mind means looking directly, keeping our awareness, being mindful of when the mind is wandering, bringing it back, and then applying concentration, whatever our practice is. Coming intimate with the breath, with the koan. Goes on, Ajahn Chah was not afraid to test the extremes in his own practice. He saw this experience as instructional for himself. He sometimes pushed people to very difficult limits and beyond. Such methods can be painful to undergo, but one comes to see where the mind holds on and limits itself, and see that the real suffering comes from the mind's attachments, fears, and preconceptions. It's a lesson we also learn in Sesshin. So much of the difficulty of Sesshin comes from our attachments, from our fears, from our ideas, from believing what we think. It says, he did not recommend fasting, vows of silence, or avoiding contact with others. He said, we practice with our eyes open. If avoiding people and sense contact were the way to enlightenment, the blind and the deaf would be enlightened. Wisdom is to be found in the realm of sense contact. The world is transcended by knowing the world, not by avoiding it. Living at close quarters with others in the same routines day after day, which is the way of life in his monasteries, can reveal a lot about one's habits and the way one creates suffering for oneself. He often said, if it's hot and difficult, that's it. That's the place of practice. Skipping ahead a bit. Paragraph here. Ajahn Chah lived in one of the more remote, unheard of, and inaccessible corners of Thailand, yet somehow a steady stream of Western seekers found their way to his monastery beginning in the late 1960s, and many ended up staying under his guidance for years. And then they quote a line from Stephen Batchelor, this, quote, pot-bellied monk who looked more like a bullfrog than a saint, had an appeal and a way of communicating truth that reached across cultural barriers and the strata of society. Over the years, he touched many hearts and shaped many lives for the better. Okay. So that's our man. This book is divided into sections, hearing Dharma, understanding Dharma, practicing Dharma, and being Dharma, sort of a roadmap of the path. We hear the truth, we begin to understand it, take it in, we put it into practice, and we reach the fruits. We become Dharma, we integrate what we've seen into our life. So this is from the chapter that's called Understanding Dharma. It says, when the mind has attained peace, that is the end of the path. This is the goal the Buddha wished everyone to realize. But before we reach the end, we need to know how to practice in order to attain a peaceful mind. Our minds are not peaceful because they have not realized the genuine Dharma. The mind is still unskilled and unreliable, lacking the wisdom that knows things as they are, that sees the truth of all phenomena or natural conditions. The word for natural conditions means existing like that, existing just as it is. Whether or not a Buddha appears in the world, phenomena exist as they are. They do not change into some other mode of existence. We are taught to begin with right understanding. Then there is right thought, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Of course, this is the Eightfold Path. It begins with right understanding, and it ends with right meditation. In our school, the emphasis is on meditation. That's what Zen Buddhism means, meditation Buddhism. And Roshi often says the whole Eightfold Path is rolled up into meditation. But there is a role for foundation. It's true that if we give ourselves wholeheartedly to meditation, understanding will come. We'll see in our own practice the hindrances that arise, the nature of reality, the foolishness of grasping, the need for right action, right speech. But it's also true that it helps to have some reflection on the nature of Dharma, nature of the path. In ancient China, so many of the great Zen masters began their careers in the Vinaya school, learning the rules of conduct and behavior for monks. When we have that understanding of the importance of morality, upright conduct, it makes it so much easier to get deeply into our practice, to let things go. Every time we try to game the system, we get in our own way. Then Ajahn Chah says there are eight, that is the Eightfold Path, there are eight, but they are really factors of the one path upon which each individual must travel. When understanding is correct, thinking will be correct, and so will speech and all the other factors. When the mind is established in what is correct, the entire progression of the path must be correct. Nothing will be wrong, and leading the path will lead to peace. The Buddha taught about letting go. When there is pleasurable experience, he said to recognize that it is merely pleasure. When there is painful experience, he said to recognize that it is merely pain. There is no one experiencing pleasure or pain, happiness or suffering. These things appear as a result of previous causes, but when we are practicing correctly, we won't find any owner of them. The Buddha taught us to see that it is merely happiness, merely suffering, not a self, a being, a person, or an individual entity. This is right view. There is no self or owner of these conditions. We think of in terms of my leg, my arm, my friends. Thus we see self. But according to Dharma, this is not seeing self. Understanding that these are not self is seeing self. You see it, but don't carry it. If you see a snake, but don't pick it up, there's no poisonous bite. It's still a snake, but the poison doesn't get you. So the Buddha said to see self. This is difficult to hear and understand. The world has its conventions. The teachings of the world, when they reach the mind of Buddha, are all false. The teachings of the enlightened ones, when they reach the mind of worldly beings, are false. When people feel they are the owners of good and bad experience, or that these things happen to themselves, they are at the mercy of impermanence. Because all things are subject to change, being attached to them can only produce experience that is unsatisfactory. You are sometimes pleased and sometimes upset as things come and go and keep changing. There is turmoil because wrong view has invaded your mind and given you mistaken ideas. You end up carrying happiness and suffering, and they get heavy for you. If there is right view, then feeling is merely feeling. Pleasure is merely pleasure. Pain is merely pain. There is no owner of either pleasure or pain. The Buddha wanted us to contemplate in this way. If we contemplate for some time, there comes about that quality of the Dharma that calls the mind to look and see what is going on. What exactly is this happiness we experience? What is this suffering we have? Are they something stable or permanent? How exactly are they? Reminds me of what Roshi Kaplow used to say, that everything is grist for the mill. Our normal response to happiness is to chase after it. Our response to suffering is to try to push it away, find a way out from underneath it. But to turn and see it doesn't mean we and not reject it. We don't need to reject happiness. We don't need to reject suffering. Just need to see. We are certainly able to look at things we've experienced before. Happiness we've had, did it end? Have we ever had unhappiness? Did it last forever? When we come to know about phenomena and don't get so involved with them, the mind becomes peaceful because we are no longer trying to own anything. Basically, we're going with the flow. Constant flux, the change. It says we can still enjoy our lives and make use of things in this world. The household items we have, kitchen goods, furniture, and so on, are not really ours. We use them, but it is in order to gain the realization that they are not ours. We use them freely and comfortably without having to suffer over them. We use them with a knowledge that is comprehensive and transcends ordinary ways. If we cannot be above these things, we're under them, carrying them with the attachment that says, "This is mine," bearing their weight. This wrong view can only lead to suffering because things will never work out exactly as we desire. Why do things break? Because they exist. Seeing things as already broken, you don't need to cry if they break. Remember when that huge Buddha figure in Afghanistan, in one of the provinces of Afghanistan, there was a Buddha figure carved into the side of a cliff. I can't remember how big it was, but it was gigantic. It was really one of the wonders of the world. And when the Taliban came in, of course, they saw it as a an idol, and they blew it up. I remember hearing some Buddhist comment. I think it was somebody from Thailand, perhaps, or somewhere in Southeast Asia, and just pointing that out, that all things pass. Even Buddha statues. There's nothing really to hold on to. Such a more healthy reaction than to turn and look at the damage that's been done and the intolerance of the Taliban and just falling into us versus them. Why do things break? Because they exist. If the cup is not mine, then without this involvement, whether it breaks or not, there is no problem. You have things in your house, so you'd better think about this. Still, you have to teach your kids to take care of things. If you just say, "It's not ours," you'll end up with no plates to eat off of. You speak in one way, but see it in another way. If you use adult concepts for children, no one cleans the dishes. Living in the world, there will always be things we must do, but we do them with letting go, and the mind is peaceful without distress, so we can work at ease. This is right livelihood. Even if we have hard, grueling work, it's okay. Think of the prayer I learned in AA. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's that ability to take care of business without being caught up in results. The Buddha wants us to escape from birth, but we want birth. What are we going to get? We don't see the liability yet. We don't see the way the Buddha sees. His teaching talked about the conceit that says, I am better than others, I am equal to others, I am worse than others. If we think in any of these ways, it is not accurate. If we don't have this conceit, there is no obstruction. It's interesting that even to say I am equal to others is a problem. Such a source of discontent is the whole business of comparing ourselves with other people. If you look around, there's plenty you can see that could be done better, but needs to be taken lightly. Because soon that critical eye will turn back on ourselves, and then we feel less than, or we feel defensive, start making excuses. Always give most people tend to give themselves a break. Conduct they see in other people that they're critical of, well, there's a reason why they do that. People want richness, riches, happiness, and so forth. They are attached to merit, only wanting tangible benefits, but not making real spiritual progress. In arithmetic, there are adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, but we only want addition and multiplication. This is just self-cherishing. People will practice their meritorious activities, but still experience sickness and other problems, and they begin to wonder, why does this happen? Where is the merit? But that isn't the point of merit and virtue. You don't seek merit to cause a cat to become a dog. It isn't something to change in the nature of conditioned phenomena. They are by nature unreliable. Whatever happens, you needn't get overly concerned or upset. Do the practice just for the sake of the practice. Take care of people just out of our love for people, not attaching to the results. The Buddha's teaching is for the purpose of helping every being to escape from the cycle of samsara, the round of birth and death. But we who have such coarse defilements of mind and feeble wisdom have different ideas. When we hear the Dharma that says nothing is ours, we become afraid that we won't get anything. It just makes us uncomfortable. Actually, we can say that these are ourselves and things are ours, but that is only a conventional reality. It is not on the level of liberation. We need to learn about the way we use conventions in all aspects of our lives. For example, our names. When we were born, we didn't bring a name with us. After we came into this world, we were given a name. There wasn't any old name to be replaced. It was empty there. In the space that is empty, you can put anything. People are born empty like this, and a name is put on them, a designation for this existence. So we can call the person John or Mary or whatever. They come to be so according to conventional understanding. They are not really John or Mary. They are a supposed John or Mary, not an ultimately true John or Mary. Really, there is no one there, just natural conditions. But if we want John to come, we have to say John. If we want to call Mary, we have to use the name she was given. It is a convenience for communicating and functioning in the world, that's all. Having been born, things pass away. Having passed away, things are born again. Birth and passing away, all conditions are like this. When we look clearly, we will come to realize that what the Buddha taught is the truth. When we see the reality of this, it is not something that will bring suffering or impoverish us. Seeing that there is no self and that nothing belongs to us will make us much more comfortable than before. We will be able to use things at ease and live in the world at ease. This is true. It isn't true on the surface. When we first look at it, it seems that, and that's why Buddhism has a reputation of being a pessimistic religion. I think one of the things that Ajahn Chah recommends is to contemplate our death at least three times a day. And yet, it does bring ease. We realize what's real and what's not real. What's not worth worrying about. Realize the nature of things is to change. Change in accordance with our wishes, they change not in accordance with our wishes. No need to be surprised. He says some people will think about this and lose the desire to do anything. They think that since they can't get anything that will be theirs, what's the use? Actually, it is those who relate to things as their own and work in order to get things for themselves who suffer so greatly. It's better if we can do work for the sake of doing it, all the while realizing that there is no self involved and nothing belongs to us, and training our minds to let go. Working and performing actions, we'll also be letting go and giving up in accordance with the truth. This is called right view, or right understanding. We know conventional reality as conventional reality and see how things appear to be and how we designate them as being such and such. The Buddha said that all these designations are empty. When he was teaching the Brahmin Mogaraja, he said, "Mogaraja, you should view this world as empty." These words can cause an ordinary person to lose heart. Seeing this world as empty, the Lord of Death will not be able to follow you. He will not see you. The Buddha taught his disciples in this way. Saying that this world is empty might give us the idea that there is nothing in the world. Mumon said, from the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. When we look at a bowl or a spittoon, these things do exist. It's not that they don't exist, but they exist in the sphere of emptiness. They exist but are empty. We can call something a spittoon as a convention that we create through our designation, or we can use another convention and call it a pot. Actually, it is empty of these names from its own side, but we view it in a certain way and then have an attachment to seeing it as such. There might be two people, one a clever sort, the other kind of foolish. The latter, the foolish one, goes to the market and buys something. He doesn't really know what it is. He has unwittingly bought a chamber pot. He takes it home and uses it as a serving bowl for his rice and feels that it does the job pretty well. He doesn't know what others use it for. When the clever guy comes along and sees this, he's startled and wonders, what is going on? What is this person doing? It's repulsive, using a chamber pot to serve rice. So one is called foolish and the other smart. Why is the latter disgusted? Why is the smart one disgusted? The pot is new. It's never been used as a chamber pot. It's clean. So why should anyone be disgusted by this? It's only attachment to an idea. And this attachment brings about revulsion and anger. Hey, look at this idiot. He's using a chamber pot to serve white rice. Of these two people, which one actually is the fool? The chamber pot is not really anything in itself. An ordinary pot is not really anything. We designate something as a chamber pot, and then if someone uses it to serve rice or soup or curry, others will feel that is a disgusting thing to do. What is the meaning of these negative feelings? It's only because of attachment to the designation, to the convention that says this is a chamber pot. It is not really a chamber pot in any absolute and unalterable way. It just depends on our perceptions and how we wish to use it. If it's clean, we can use it for a lot of purposes. If we understand the truth like this, there really isn't anything to get worked up over. We're not the owners of anything. We can use serving dishes, chamber pots, and ordinary pots without any problem. These things don't name themselves. We could call them a number of things. Whatever convention will work is fine. So it is said that our speech should be one thing, but the mind another. If others are calling something a spittoon, we can do that too. If they call something a chamber pot, we can do that. Means adjusting ourselves to speak in accordance with the world, matching our ways to the ways of this world in which we live. Buddha and his disciples lived with society at large. They lived together with every kind of person, good and bad, wise and foolish. They were able to fit in anywhere because they understood the facts of conventional reality and ultimate reality. When you have this understanding, the mind is comfortable, at peace. There will be no attachment or clinging. This is the natural result of right view. You know what is convention, what is liberation, and the mind is free of disturbance, letting things go. I want to read a little something that my guy Anthony DeMello says about this whole question of how we label things. He says, the important thing is not to know who I is or what I is. You'll never succeed. There are no words for it. The important thing is to drop the labels. As the Japanese Zen masters say, don't seek the truth, just drop your opinions. Drop your theories. Don't seek the truth. Truth isn't something you search for. If you stop being opinionated, you would know. Something similar happens here. If you drop your labels, you would know. What do I mean by labels? Every label you can conceive of except, perhaps, that of human being. I am a human being, fair enough, doesn't say very much. But when you say, I am successful, that's crazy. Success is not part of the I. Success is something that comes and goes. It could be here today and gone tomorrow. That's not I. When you said, I was a success, you were in error. You were plunged into darkness. You identified yourself with success. The same thing when you said, I'm a failure, a lawyer, a businessman. You know what's going to happen to you if you identify yourself with these things. You're going to cling to them. You're going to be worried that they may fall apart, and that's where your suffering comes in. That is what I meant earlier when I said, if you're suffering, you're asleep. Do you want a sign that you're asleep? Here it is. You're suffering. Suffering is a sign that you're out of touch with the truth. So an interesting woman named Byron Katie who said, suffering is like a compassionate alarm clock. It tells us we're lost in the dream. Suffering is given to you, this is Anthony DeMello again, is given to you that you might open your eyes to the truth, that you might understand that there's falsehood somewhere, just as physical pain is given to you so you will understand that there is disease or illness somewhere. Suffering points out that there is falsehood somewhere. Suffering occurs when you clash with reality. When your illusions clash with reality, when your falsehoods clash with truth, then you have suffering. Otherwise, there is no suffering. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.